Hello, and welcome to New Books in African American Studies, the interview series where writers of African American arts, life, culture, and sciences discuss their new books. I'm your host, Vershawn Young, and today I will be talking with Richard Lehman. He is one of the co-editors, along with Bernard Duffy, of The Will of a People, a critical anthology of great African American speeches published by Southern Illinois University Press in 2012. This book draws upon nearly 200 years of recorded African-American oratory and brings together in one unique volume 22 of the most noteworthy speeches in African-American life and culture. Each is paired with a comprehensive introduction that's designed to highlight its most significant elements. The orators listed here range from Mariah Miller Stewart to Barack Obama. We're sure that you will find this lively exchange with Richard Lehman very informative and provocative. Please listen. Hello, Richard.
Hello, Dr. Vay.
Richard W. Lehman is a professor of communication studies at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. He is the author or editor of five books, including African American Orators, a biocritical sourcebook, and with co-editor Bernard Duffy, American Voices, an Encyclopedia of Contemporary American Orators. He has received several awards and has served as a scholar in residence for an NEH-sponsored summer seminar on African-American oratory. We're delighted to have Professor Lehman on the show today to discuss his latest book, The Will of a People, a critical anthology of great African-American speeches published by Southern Illinois University Press in 2012. This book is a compendium of 22 orations delivered by African-Americans over a span of over 265 years. Co-edited by frequent collaborators Lehman and Duffy, both professors of communication studies, both interested in the American tradition of public address, have spotlighted the African-American oral tradition in public testimonies, speeches, declarations, and jeremiads, among other possible categories of purpose in Black oratory. Limited by such constraints as space and copyrights, the speeches included are those considered great, either because the speech itself is a famous speech like Sojourner's Truth's Ain't I a Woman, or because it is considered the finest speech delivered by an influential orator like Henry Turner's I Claim the Rights as a Man. Whatever the reason for their inclusion, it's no doubt the speeches collected are inspirational, informative, and worth studying as part of American cultural history and oratorical history that continues to this very moment. In fact, capturing the contemporary milieu, the book also contains the first inaugural address by Barack Obama, the first U.S. president of color. So, covering an impressive range, The Will of a People gives readers much to think about, debate, and contemplate. We're happy to have Professor Lehman on the show to discuss this book with us today. Richard, can you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, I'm a professor of communication studies at UNC Charlotte. I've been here for 23 years. My PhD is from the University of Maryland in public communication. And I've been teaching a class here at UNC Charlotte in African American oratory since the early 1990s, and that's really where the book grew out of.
Very nice. And when you started teaching that class in African American oratory, what was the genesis for it?
Well, actually, it's one of those strange kind of life journey sorts of things. You actually have to go back to my undergraduate years. I was a history secondary education major, anticipating going in for a graduate degree in history, but I was on the competitive speech and debate team. And my debate coach said, you know, I think you'd like to do rhetorical criticism as an event. And I said, you know, he explained what it was. And I said, okay. And he said, here, I think you'd really like to analyze this speech. You'd have a good time with it. You'd find it interesting. And he gave me Stokely Carmichael's Black Power speech that he delivered at Berkeley. And so I did that, analyzed that speech as, you know, then a competitive event. And I was really very, very fascinated. And I had never, it had never really come within my scope of experience before that, but I was very interested by it. When I got to graduate school, I actually started on working on an MA in Russian history for a couple of years. and decided that was not a career path for me. And so I switched my major as a graduate student to communication studies. And oddly enough, again, as I was trying to piece together a schedule at the last moment, even though it wasn't a graduate class, it was an undergraduate class, Lindsay Niles, the chair of communication studies at Howard University, was teaching a part-time class at night at University of Maryland. And even though it wasn't a graduate class, he was teaching one on black rhetoric in America. And I thought this would be a fascinating class to take. And so I signed up for it and took it. And ever since then, certainly African-American rhetoric and oratory has been a subject of interest to me. So when I came to UNC Charlotte and had an opportunity to develop a class, I thought this would be a good class to develop.
Very nice. Since our readers constitute a very broad audience, can you tell us a little bit about what you mean by rhetorical criticism and the study of rhetoric?
Well, rhetorical criticism goes back to the idea that, you know, rhetoric is the art of persuasion. And so when we try to speak, or of course, many times when we try to write or put together films or whatever, we're trying to persuade people. And so rhetorical criticism is trying to delve into and understand more thoroughly how we put together persuasion. How are we trying to go ahead and persuade people? And that's really one of the features of the book that is really one of the reasons I put the book together. That is, each of the speeches has a pretty extended introduction that does rhetorical criticism of the speech. And so, for example, looking at Henry Highland Garnett's address to the slaves as a piece of exhortative discourse. And what does that mean to say that it's exhortative? And where do you see that in his speech as one way of understanding his speech? And we've done that with each of the speeches, where we try to help give the reader a deeper way of understanding the speech. And then immediately after, a well-annotated and authoritative as they can be, version of the speech.
Very nice. So you've already segued into my next question, which is, why this book? How did it come about?
Well, it did come about because of me teaching the course in African-American oratory. And I just felt that there was a gap in the literature, that you had anthologies that were very, very encyclopedic. Philip Foner's, you know, Voice of Black America, and then the reissue of that volume for speeches before 1900. But the introductions were relatively brief. Or you had a few anthologies that would give you a bit longer introductions, but they really didn't then span the scope of African-American oratory, try to cover from early speeches to later speeches and try to pick some of the best of those. And so this book really was, as I said, grew out of the class where I felt that it would be useful to have a volume that covered some of the best speeches. In many ways, it hardly scratches the surface to look at 22 speeches, obviously, but try to look at some of the best ones, try to get a range of issues, try to get a range of time periods that are represented, and provide substantive introductions that help guide the reader as he or she looks at then goes in and reads the speech. And also not only give the rhetorical criticism, but also try to give the historical context of the speech, because obviously orators are addressing and persuading particular audiences at particular moments in time.
So is this what you mean in the title, that it's a critical anthology, that it tries to contextualize the speech, it gives some historical context, as well as other scholarly information?
That's exactly why it's the subtitle is A Critical Anthology of Great African-American Speeches. And oddly enough, also, if you notice, it even says edited with introductions by Bernie Duffy and myself, because actually about half of the book is the matter is the introductions. It's somewhere around 40-45% are the introductions, so that the reader is, you know, guided and into the reading of the speeches.
Very nice. So many of these speeches of the 22 a reader that's interested could probably find them elsewhere. So why did you choose these particular speeches to collect in this volume? For example, I'm thinking about Booker T. Washington's speech, Frederick Douglass's speech on the what to the American slave is the 4th of July. These are quite accessible. So why in the book?
Well, like I said, I think a couple of reasons. One is that while you could find these a lot of different places, one of the things that we did was make sure that we were going for versions that were as authoritative as possible. So while you can find a number of versions of Douglass's, so you know, what to the slave is the 4th of July, we did go back and line by line take it out of the publication that that came out in 1852 of the speech, and so make sure that we get it as authoritative as possible. The second thing we tried to do with these is we also tried to heavily annotate them. So lines of poetry, lines that come out of the Bible, peoples who are referenced in passing, we go ahead and annotate who these people are or where these lines came from so that the reader can know more of what the audience was bringing to it. For example, it's not always noted that the line of poetry, the extended line of poetry that Douglass ends his speech with, is from William Lloyd Garrison. Well, that's important since in the speech he's taking issue with Garrison's interpretation of the Constitution, that you know that Douglass is essentially extending an olive branch at the end of it to the Garrisonians, you know, even though he is very directly taking issue with their interpretation and has broken with their interpretation of the Constitution. And then the third reason is that while people can find these online, we did want to make it very easy for the reader to be able to read the introduction and the historical context to the speech, and then go ahead and have the speech in front of them in print form that they can then take notes on or have right there for them. They don't have to read the introduction and then go search for the speech online.
And in the introduction, you talk a little bit about the difference in hearing a speech and reading a speech. Can you tell us what we gain from reading the speech and what we might miss from not being able to hear it?
Well, that of course, in some ways, is the unanswerable question. What would it have sounded like to hear Sojourner Truth or Francis Harper or Maria Miller Stewart or Frederick Douglass? In many ways, we can only guess. Obviously, there are times when if the audio tapes are available or videotapes are available, one of the things that I would hope is that the book provides a springboard for readers to become interested in pulling those speeches up and listening to them, because it isn't the same reading Barbara Jordan's speech on paper than to hear her speech to the Judiciary Committee at the Watergate hearings, or certainly Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. Hearing it is different than reading it. There is, though, one advantage, though, with being able to put things down on paper, and that is, as you can well appreciate, is that people do write things very carefully, and sometimes when we just hear things, we don't necessarily slow down and look at the nuances of what a speaker or persuader has put on into the speech, whether consciously or unconsciously. And so the one thing that reading does allow you to do is sort of put the words on out there, contemplate them and read them and reread them, that you see things that you might not see or hear when you're listening to the speech. And so I would encourage people anytime they can to both, hear the speech or see it and read it for any speech. I mean, just as an example, I mean, I certainly see things in Obama's speeches, when I sit down and start reading them that I might not have heard the first time listening to them. I encourage them to really consume the speeches in both forms when you have the opportunity to do that.
And what do we gain from this? I mean, I understand the academic and scholarly import of studying the speeches, but what as a culture, as people, individuals, would we gain from reading these speeches?
Well, I think we gain a lot in terms of understanding where we have come from, who we are as a people, and I mean that as an American people. African Americans are, you know, are fully vested and important players in American history. I mean, you can, you know, there's more examples than one can think about how African Americans have influenced and been influenced by American history. They're you know, an integral part of our history, and I say our, you know, very broadly. What can we learn from them? Well, I'm going to steal a line that I heard at one panel presentation from a fellow, Phil Jones. He said, those who forget the past are condemned to make it up. And that's, I think, too often, of course, what we do. We make up what we think the past is. We make up what where we think we've come from. And I think that one of the things that this does, it's not just an academic study. It really is a study that gets us looking at what people said, how they tried to persuade each other, who they were arguing against at the time. Because when you look at these speeches, you're not only seeing, you know, people, what they're saying, how they think they might be able to persuade audiences, but of course you're also looking at it and you start to understand who they are responding to, because of how they structure their arguments or how they make their appeals. So you get a sense of what our history was. I don't have any doubt about the value of going and looking at African-American oratory, in part because I have taught this course for over 20 years here at UNC Charlotte. And every time I teach it, the one thing I get from it is students walking out at the end of the semester saying that was a really good course, and they have a much better appreciation of who they are and who America is. And the fascinating thing is that was as true in 1991 when I first taught the course as it is in the fall 2012, which is the most recent time I've taught the course. Students. And I get students of all ages. I get middle-aged students in there. I get 18, 19-year-olds in there. And they walk on out of that course saying that they have a much better appreciation for the events of America, for the history of America, and for who we are here in the 21st century. So I think that, I don't have any doubt about the value, and I don't think it's purely academic.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I actually really appreciated about reading the book, especially the introductions, the primary introduction as well as the introduction to each orator, is that the writing is very accessible, easy to understand, but yet extremely weighty and substantial. And it actually allowed me to take another look at even some of the more familiar speeches, ones that I often read and teach, like Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. I really appreciated the way in which the introduction was handled, and as you said, annotating the references that he draws from, very well done. I really commend the work that you and Professor Duffy did in this book. Let me ask you this question. What is African American rhetoric? How does it differ from American rhetoric? Why is there a distinction to be made between African American orators and American orators? Do they they obviously draw from similar sources and principles, as I see in your book? But what's the difference? What's the distinction?
Well, that's a good question, and I'm not sure that I've got an authoritative answer for that. I think that's one of the things that is so rich about the study of this area, and something that I commend to a lot of people to as a question to ask, and particularly for those of us who are academics. But I look at it this way, and that is one of the reasons that I find speeches fascinating is because at some level, the person giving the speech has to take those words on as his or her own. And typically they do. Okay. Short of somebody drafting a speech and handing it to the person and they just read it off the teleprompter and couldn't care less about what they're saying. Most people don't do that. A speech is the spoken words coming from them. Okay. So in that sense, African American rhetoric or oratory is a public speech given by a person who self-identifies as African American. That's part of who they see they are. And whenever we speak out of our own sense of ethos, our sense of who we are. And so in that sense, there is that kind of commonality between these speakers, okay, that they have self-identified as being and speaking from the African American culture and experience. Now, beyond that, when you start generalizing, you run into trouble because that's one of the things that we're hoping that is communicated in this volume. You have such a tremendous range of opinions, viewpoints, rhetorical appeals, ways that people speak, it is not something to say, oh, well, that's African American rhetoric or I'm always, always bothered by those who will look at a Martin Luther King Jr. and a Jesse Jackson and say, oh, well, that's the black style of speaking. And I look at these and say, well, that's a black style of speaking. It is a black preaching style of speaking. But it hardly is representative, of a Francis Harper or Maria Miller Stewart. And you can go on and on in terms of a whole range of speaking. It certainly doesn't sound like Ida B. Wells Barnett. It doesn't particularly sound like Mary Church Terrell. I'm always bothered by that because when you take a look at African American oratory, it really represents the range. And in that sense, there is that sense in which that you reference. That is, it is drawing off of many of the things that you would find in American oratory. The Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, drawing off those sorts of the Bible, Shakespeare, drawing off of those. But yet it's still speaking from the African American culture and experience. The other point though about African American oratory that I always make, and I think it's important, is that as we talk about in the introduction, public speaking has been a particularly important persuasive resource for African Americans because it was one that is not resource heavy. Many, many other avenues, the printing press, for example. It's expensive to maintain printing presses, and it's one of the reasons that you find African-American printing houses continually coming in existence but then going on out of existence, a very difficult one. Controlling radio and television and those sorts of media have typically been expensive. Public speaking has been a rhetorical resource that available to African Americans, and I think that they have used it extraordinarily well and extraordinarily eloquently throughout American history, which is another point that draws me to putting together a volume of African American speeches, but also particularly trying to look at some of those that are particularly eloquent.
Okay, let me follow that up with two other questions. The first one is, in your work on American voices or American orators, how diverse is that characterization of American? In other words, which orators do you include in that work?
With the contemporary American orators, which we kind of pick up right around the Kennedy years, we pick up in there, if I'm not mistaken, we pick up, I'd have obviously Martin Luther King, we pick up Stokely Carmichael, Malcolm X, I think we have Faye Waddleton on in there, we have Jesse Jackson. That one came out a bit before Barack Obama really kind of hit the waves. Trying to think who else we end up picking on up in there. Barbara Jordan, Shirley Chisholm, Okay. You know, we try to, in that volume, you know, be diverse, and again, try to sample from a, you know, a range of speakers, both from the standpoint of what their backgrounds are, what their political affiliations are. So we make that attempt. With that volume, as with this volume, there will always be people who say, well, why not this speech or why not that speaker? But at some point, you have to give in to the realities of that you've got space and time limitations at some point. So
right.
It's got to be done. My dream, you know, would be to get a second volume of the Will of the People on out. If there was enough demand for the first one, so that we could get some more on out there and get some of the voices that are a little less heard
Very
on
nice.
Out there as well.
Here's my next question. Many of the orators that you include in the book, let's say Booker T. Washington, Francis Harper, Ida B. Wells, Frederick Douglass, are also authors. What's the relationship between their speeches and their literary or nonfiction works?
Oh, I think for all of them, I think there's a close relationship if you look at that, because I think that their writing certainly affects their speaking, and their speaking affects their writing. Some of them you can identify far more. Francis Harper, for example, certainly has moments of just being very poetic in her oratory. Ida B. Wells Barnett does come across more as a journalist, even in her public speaking. It's very facts and figures oriented. She is reporting the facts and does not want people to dispute that. Frederick Douglass, you always have the sense that when he's giving a speech, he has an appreciation that he or somebody else is likely to reprint it, and you will end up seeing it in written form. As communicators, I think perhaps scholars, make a distinction, and certainly I have, between the public speaking and the writing. But as human beings, we're communicators, whether we're giving a speech, whether we're talking in conversation, or whether we're writing things down. And certainly there's an overlap between all the different modes of communication. One is going to influence the other.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite speech in the volume?
Oh, boy, that's a hard one, because you have to remember, I mean, I chose the speeches. They're all ones that, I find as favorites. Boy, that's like asking me who my favorite child is. Seriously, that is difficult. I certainly would say I think Frederick Douglass is the most eloquent English-speaking orator. You pick up anything by him, and it's just outstanding. And certainly, What to the Slave is the 4th of July is a good one. But we also have in the volume his speech at the dedication of the Lincoln Memorial, which it isn't necessarily as eloquent as some of his other things, but it's certainly hugely interesting in how he tries to approach that rhetorical situation. I think others of mine, I do still have a fondness for Stokely Carmichael's Black Power speech, the first one, African American speech that was really given to me to study. I love Francis Harper's speech. I love Henry McNeil Turner's "I Claim the Rights of Man." Francis Harper's speech, I like that one because I think it has one of the most eloquent lines in there when she's responding to how people criticize African Americans for being ignorant, and therefore, of course, since they're ignorant, they shouldn't be given the right to vote. And she has just one of the most well-turned phrases in there when she says, "It comes with ill grace for a man who has put out my eyes to make a parade of my blindness." And that's the poet in her,
mm-hmm.
clearly. clearly speaking. Henry McNeil Turner, just the kind of spit in his eye that he's got from start to finish in that speech as he just sort of dresses down the Georgia State Legislature is to me inspirational. That's a hard one. I don't know about.
Well, you did such a great job answering it.
Yeah,
it's fair to say that you like a lot of them. A lot of them are your favorite.
Well, like I say, I chose them. So, I will say I have to also give a plug. I think Barbara Jordan's Watergate speech from start to finish is 15 minutes of just pure eloquence. Mm-hmm. And when you think that with that one that she basically compiled it over her dinner hour, she'd been making notes over the previous weeks and things like that. But that was basically written over the dinner hour. That's just an amazing tour de force.
Can I push you a little bit to attempt a definition or an explanation of eloquence in these speeches? What do you mean by eloquence? And let me tell you why I'm asking that question, for two reasons. One, as you clearly delineate in the primary introduction to the text, these speeches are so diverse. The rhetorical styles are extremely different. I mean, Malcolm X's speech is different, say, from Frederick Douglass's speech. Stokely Carmichael certainly, although he has a wide array of styles in his speeches, his Black Power speech is different from Vernon John's speech. What marks Black eloquence?
Well, I think what marks any eloquence, no matter who the speaker is. I like Longinus's definition of eloquence, and he defines eloquence as the unity of thought and diction. That is, sort of that perfect marriage of what the content is and the inspirational portion of the content. That is, you can't be eloquent about, why we need more paper clips in the supply cabinet. You need to be talking about important things. So the content needs to be important and inspirational, and it has to have the marriage then with the language and the form in which we put those ideas. And that's really what I take as being eloquent. And that's why, even though you can look at diverse styles, you still find them being eloquent because the style matches the person and the time and the message. So that, a Sojourner Truth certainly is not going to speak like a Francis Harper.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And yet, for what Sojourner Truth was saying at that moment and how she was expressing herself, I think it is a marriage, a very strong marriage between how she phrases it, how she organizes it, the form of the language, and the content that she is conveying to the audience, and it is inspirational content that she has to me. And I'd say the same thing about Frances Harper. Or, we talk about differences, between the different orders. One of the reasons I particularly wanted to put in Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech at Riverside Church against the Vietnam War is because that speech sounds very different from the I Have a Dream speech mm-hmm. to me. But he's doing something different in it, and they're both eloquent in my mind, but they're doing different things. And so he uses different language. He uses different kinds of appeals. He uses different forms. And one of the reasons I like putting those two in, as well as putting in the two by Frederick Douglass, is to remind us that, it's not just that it is that we can't think in terms of African-Americans speaking with a monolithic voice. They are individuals. But even an individual speaks differently at different times, in different places, for different purposes.
Mm-hmm. When you either talk about the speeches or teach them, what are the points within any speech that generally tends to get a lot of attention. Are there any moments that your students or colleagues find controversial in any of the speeches or any of the moments that they find particularly interesting?
Oh, well, I think they find a lot of the moments very interesting. I think, but it starts with the very first speech where Maria Miller Stewart is in her speech, the one that I have in the book and the one that I teach in class, where part of the towards the end of it. She basically says to her audience about how they need to comport themselves as a credit to their race, okay? Which is, of course, a fully charged phrase that's on out there, and that particularly among my African American students will generate a discussion because it starts to bring into this flow that you're going to look at these speeches and say that there's some things you agree with and some things you don't necessarily agree with. And here is a courageous woman standing up amongst a lot of criticism to stand up and say what she believes. Early in the speech, she's dressing down the white members of the audience, saying, "Why aren't you hiring African Americans? Basically, shame on you." And the students can identify with that, but then they kind of look later and go, "Whoa, whoa, wait a minute, you know." But it also impresses them because then I'll have some African American students who will then say, "Oh yeah, I've heard that within my family. I've heard that." Others will say, "No, we've moved beyond that." And it gets a discussion then, so that you start, as you say, it's highly charged to start talking in those terms. And that's a fairly early speech. But the other thing that it does for those who say, "Yeah, I've kind of heard that, or I've had members of my, neighborhood or family say that sort of thing," then when they realize that this is a speech from 1832 and we're sitting in class in fall of 2012, they go, "Wow, some things change and some things don't change." And they start getting that sense of that there are some continuities, whether you agree with that sentiment or don't agree with that sentiment. And I'll have students argue both ways on it. They will, they start to realize that these ancient speeches can in fact speak to them right in modern contemporary times. And we'll get that kind of replayed on out when we get to things like Booker T. Washington's speech, or certainly when we get to Turner's speech, we will get that. There's a lot of highly charged things in here because there are going to be things that the speakers say that they will disagree with quite clearly.
If you had the space to include one more, just one more speech, which one would that be?
I think without doubt, Fannie Lou Hamer. I'd like to get one of her speeches on. I think it would be good to get a female voice of the civil rights movement. And she certainly was very eloquent in a way that, even though there are a number of 1960s speakers in there, obviously, a Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, Martin Luther King Jr., would like to have a female voice and like to have a voice that's from the front lines. That would be the first one I'd put on in. And then the second one I'd go to is certainly, I think I'd try to find a good speech by Mary McLeod Bethune. Get a female voice from the kind of that 1930s, 1940s period. But Fannie Lou Hamer's the first one I'd go for.
Thank you so much. Well, I've taken up a lot of your time today, but I do want to ask you one other question. Are you working on anything now?
Well, I am, but not only am I working on something, actually, and more perhaps apropos to our discussion, I recently did come out with a volume on the teleological discourse of Barack Obama with Lexington Press. And I've been excited about also having that one on out and talking with some people about that that volume, and that's been a that's been really a delightful project for me to work on.
What's the title?
It's called The Teleological Discourse of Barack Obama. And obviously what I'm arguing in there is that his discourse is heavily teleological, that he comes at his discourse as far back as his autobiographies, really with a teleological frame of reference.
Wow.
And
Well, maybe we can have you back on the show to discuss that book.
I would be delighted. I would be delighted. This has been a great conversation, and I do want to go back to something that you had said earlier, and thank you that when you said about how the writing was accessible but challenging and really contextualized. I want to thank you. That was high praise indeed. And if the book is able to do that, then we've hit the mark that we were setting for ourselves, because we wanted this really to be something that a general reader, a college student, freshman could pick on up and perhaps be challenged by the ideas, but not overwhelmed by them. It really is a labor of love and trying to get more people reading these speeches and appreciating these speeches and their place in history.
Professor Lehman, thank you so much for joining us on New Books in African American Studies.
Well, again, thank you very much for having me.
We've been talking with Professor Richard Lehman about his co-edited collection, The Will of a People, a critical anthology of great African American speeches. This book is designed to be taught in undergraduate and graduate courses focusing on American U.S. history, African American and American rhetoric, public address, and rhetorical traditions. It's also quite appropriate for mainstream audiences. The educated reader will find much to mine about the rhetorical tradition of African Americans also, and American history in general. We hope you go out and get your copy today.